The ultimate word is I like. It is I like that makes the drunk drink and the martyr wear a hair shirt. It's why I am building a boat. I am so made. I like. That's all. The trip around the world means big moments of living. Here are the seas, the winds, and the waves of all the world. Here is ferocious environment. And here is difficult adjustment, the achievement of which is delight to the small quivering vanity that is I. I like. I am so made.
Jack, by Steve May, with Keith Alexander as Jack London.
February 18, 1906. Jack London, renowned author of such stirring adventure stories as The Call of the Wild and The Sea Wolf, is to undertake a real-life adventure of his own. Namely, to circumnavigate the globe in a small boat. And not alone, but accompanied by his wife.
Glen Ellyn, California, February 18, 1906.
To Bailey Millard, editor, Cosmopolitan Magazine. Dear Millard, the keel is laid. The boat is to be 45 feet long. It would have been shorter, but I found it impossible to squeeze a bathroom in otherwise. I sail in October. Hawaii is to be the first port of call. From there, we shall wander in the South Seas, calling out Australia, and then up through the Philippines to Japan, then Korea and China, and on down to India. Red Sea, Mediterranean, Black Sea, and Baltic, and on across the Atlantic to New York. Then around the Horn and home to San Francisco.
To Mr. Collier, Collier's Magazine.
I shall certainly put in a winter in St. Petersburg, and there isn't a European country in which I shall not spend from 1 to 7 months. This leisurely fashion will obtain throughout the whole trip. I shall not be in a rush. In fact, I calculate 7 years at least will be taken up by the trip.
To Mr. McClure, McClure's Magazine.
This boat is to be sailed by one friend and myself. There are no sailors. My wife accompanies me. With our own hands, we're going to circumnavigate the globe. Of course, I'll take a cook along and a cabin boy, but these will be Asiatics, and we'll have no part in the sailorizing. Why should we stew over a stove and set the table?
Mr. Hayden Carruth, editor, Woman's Home Companion.
I have tremendous confidence that I can deliver the goods. Anybody doubting this has but to read The People of the Abyss to find the graphic, repertorial way I have of handling things. I gathered every bit of the material, wrote it, and typed it out all in 2 months. That's going some now, isn't it? This is something that's never been done before. No writer of prominence in the days of his prominence has ever gone sailing around the world. We expect lots of action. And my strong point as a writer is that I am a writer of action. Another point is that while I am a writer, I am also a sailor, having spent years on the water and before the mast. And now comes the item of pay. Traveler correspondents are usually expensive because their traveling expenses are paid by their employers. But in my case, I'd pay my own traveling expenses. I build my boat, I outfit my boat, and I run my boat. Whatever conclusion we arrive at, it must be stipulated that I receive in advance, in the course of the building of the boat, say, $3,000. Please let me hear from you at your early convenience. Sincerely yours, Jack London.
The editor of Cosmopolitan stated his willingness to make the advance, and Jack shot back, "All right, we sail October the 1st. I'm going to turn out some Cracker Jack stuff on this trip." He's put my uncle, Roscoe Eames, upon a salary to superintend the construction of the boat.
Roscoe, in answer to your questions, spare no money. Let everything on our boat be of the best. And never mind decoration, put the money in the construction. Let her be as staunch and strong as any boat afloat. Never mind what it costs to make her staunch and strong. You see to it that she's made staunch and strong, and I'll go on writing and earning the money to pay for it.
Have I mentioned that Jack is fond of ordering advertised articles? Many are the packages, great and small, that enliven our morning mail as we prepare for our voyage. For Jack means to leave nothing behind that will contribute to the venture's success. Oh, fishing tackle of the most alluring, countless strings of beads of all sizes and hues to gladden savage hearts that beat beneath the Southern Cross. Gay neckerchiefs and calicoes and ribbons, nothing is omitted. and the fun we have, like various children opening our Christmas packages from day to day, can best be imagined.
May 16, 1906, dear Millard. You asked for my picture alongside the hull. There ain't no hull. The iron keel, wooden keel, stem, and a few ribs are standing, and so they have been standing for some time. I haven't been near the boat yet, and do not expect to go until it's practically finished. I'm too busy.
Oh, Jack is capable of such adorable, pretty ways. One afternoon, he and I, with Manyungi's help, were sorting over old possessions, making ready long in advance of our voyage. The Korean came upon my old French doll. Lifting it very tenderly, reverence in his handsome olive face, the boy carried it to Jack, who was talking to himself amidst a tumbled mountain of dusty books. He invariably talks and hums when doing work of this kind. And Jack, with a dewy look in those great eyes, held out both grimy hands for the relic and kissed it. The act was devoid of affectation, just a spontaneous expression of all the complication of his love.
Dear Millard, you'll have to defer my opening article until the November number. I have finally succumbed to the California earthquake. I find it impossible to get a decent engine this side of New York, and the consequent delay throws me back a full month. I shall sail November the 1st instead of October the 1st.
We're going to call her the Snark. Jack's reason is that he can think of no other name that suits. And his friends, with bright suggestions of the call of the wild, the sea wolf, and the game, have quite worn him out.
August 13, 1906. Dear Millard, I never thought about naming the boat Cosmopolitan. Boats, like horses, should have names of one syllable. There's one thing that wouldn't make me change the name Snark to Cosmopolitan, namely the presentation of the Snark to me as an out-and-out present. In return for such a present...
Jack titters as he dictates the outrage to me.
In return for such a present, not only would I put up with a five-syllable Cosmopolitan, why, I'd even take subscriptions for the magazine as I go along.
August 27.
To Gaylord Wilshire, Wilshire's Magazine. Dear Mr. Wilshire, with reference to your request for an article... Say, if you'd asked me for my wife or my ranch, it would have been easier for me to have given them to you than to give you that article. I'm so absolutely rushed to death with my work, writing, and with the stupendous volume of details of building the boat and preparing for the departure, that I cannot even think of what to write in such an article, much less find the time in which to write it. Think, why, all I can think about these days is how to make sea anchors, how to make electricity, how to make gasoline engines go, how to store 1,000 gallons of gasoline on a boat where there isn't room for 500 gallons, how to navigate... My God, man, do you realize that in a few short weeks we set sail and I haven't had a bit of time in which to learn navigation? Time? If you can see any way to manage it, I'd sooner you sent me 200 hours of time than $200.
Our duties have piled up and we are rushing all hours, except for the swimming, rides to the ranch, the campfire gatherings, moonlight romps, and games with boxing, kiting, and whatnot. Blowing soap bubbles was popular for a time.
The Snark! The Snark will be a dry boat, at least during the sea stretches. My system will be cleansed of the alcohol it soaks in. Then when we reach port, I'll be in shape to enjoy John Barleycorn more thoroughly. His bite will be sharper, his kick keener, and more delicious.
October 20th, 1906.
Dear Millard, magazine editors are sharp and unprincipled businessmen. I've made a practice of not noticing their misdeeds against me, but now I'm going to jump back. Don't you think I've got a kick coming for the way you've advertised me as going around the world for the Cosmopolitan? Hell, everybody thinks the Cosmopolitan is building my boat for me and paying all my expenses and giving me a princely salary on top of it, all on the strength of your miserable guaranteed $3,000. The initial cost of my boat is running past the $12,000 mark, to say nothing of the expenses of running said boat. San Francisco is mad. Prices have climbed out of sight. The outlook is now that I shall not sail before January. Weeks go by without a tap of work being done on the boat. Can't get the men. The earthquake has destroyed the local market, and freight is congested. Now, the next time you go out looking for trouble, be sure you jump the right man. Sincerely yours, Jack London.
One evening, while passing away an hour with my favorite magazine, my attention was attracted to an article describing a proposed trip around the world on a little 45-foot boat by Jack London and a party of five.
No, adventure is not dead in spite of Thomas Cook and Son. When the announcement of the voyage was made, young men of roving disposition proved to be legion.
Doctors, lawyers, beggarmen, chiefs, thieves, multimillionaires, sailors, single and in crews, poets, historians, geologists, painters, doctors of divinity. In short, men, women, and children of every color and occupation write or telegraph or pay us calls imploring to sail on any terms, or none, or even appealing to pay for the privilege.
With two or three exceptions, all the hundreds that volunteer for my crew are very much in earnest.
I was all aglow with enthusiasm, and before I'd finished that article, I had determined that if the boat made a trip such as described, I was going to be on that boat. Needless to say, the letter I wrote to Mr. Jack London was as strong as I could make it. I told him all I could do, and some things I couldn't.
November 17, 1906.
Dear Martin E. Johnson, in reply to your letter, all right. And now for some details of what you're in for. As for the crew, all of us will be the crew. There's my wife and myself. We will stand our watches and do our trick at the wheel. Incidentally, a large portion of our time will be used in working in order to pay the expenses of the trip. My wife's uncle, Mr. Roscoe Eames, will act as co-navigator with me. The fourth member of the crew is Manyungi, a boy of your own age. He's as brave as a lion and as gentle as a lamb. He will be cabin boy and look after the personal needs of myself and Mrs. London. And now comes the fifth member of the crew, the cook, which, it seems, will be yourself. Beside the cooking, you will merely have to pass the food to the cabin boy. It must be thoroughly understood that when we're on duty, the relations existing will be that of captain and crew. Off duty is another matter. We can then be friends or enemies or not speak when we pass by. From the present outlook, we shall sail out of San Francisco Bay on December 15. If you have a bad temper, don't come, for it'd be the only one on the boat. Incidentally, if you like boxing, I may tell you that all of us box, and we'll have the gloves along. You'll have the advantage of us on reach. Give my regards to your father and my thanks for the kind letter he enclosed with yours.
November 22nd.
To the American Socialist Monthly, dear comrades, in reply to your telegram, first of all, I don't know if I can succeed in serializing the Iron Heel in some of the big magazines. If I can do so and get $10,000 for it, why, I'll certainly do so. I'm mortgaging my ranch in order to build my boat, and such a deal would help me out. Also, some very excellent socialist propaganda will be thereby spread. On the other hand, if it proves too strong for any of the conventional magazines, then I shall be only too glad to have the American Socialist serialize it.
November 24th.
Dear Millard, I've just seen the Christmas number of Cosmopolitan. You got the boat article out beautifully and are featuring it splendidly, for which two things you have my thanks. But on top of that, I have a howl coming, a regular long wolf howl. I don't like the way you've taken liberties with my copy. I weave my stuff. You can cut a whole piece of it, but you can't cut out parts of it and leave mutilated parts behind. If the whole woven thing is not suitable for your magazine, why, cut it out. Cut out the whole thing. I don't care. Now, I wanted to give warning right here. I won't stand for it. And before I stand for it, I'll throw over the whole proposition. If you dare do it again, I won't send you another line. Do you think for one moment I'll write my heart, oh, my skilled professional heart, if you please, into my work to have you fellas slaughtering it to suit your journalistic tastes? Either I'm going to write this set of articles or you're going to write it for. No, right here, that I refuse definitely and flatly to collaborate with you or anyone in your office.
December 1st, 1906.
To Mr. George P. Brett, Macmillan Company. Dear Mr. Brett, this is the last letter I sent from Glen Ellen. We've said goodbye to the ranch and are now packed up and on the eve of starting for Oakland. I saw the many advertisements with which you're shoving along White Fang. It does my heart good to see them, for you've no idea how much I'm pinning my financial faith and hopes upon that book. The unexpected and exceeding expense of building the boat has caught me hard. Mrs. Nanetta Eames of Glen Ellen will be left with power of attorney for me. She will transact most of my business, etc. Now, in case she should need money suddenly, I'd like to have the assurance that she could call upon you for an advance. There are various families and people that I'm taking care of, and I'd like to have the assurance that in case of their sudden and simultaneous need, and in case little or no ready cash remained to my account,
said Mrs. Eames could call upon you for, well, up to $1,000 in advance of royalties. This will make me feel safer out on the ocean.
I arrived in Oakland about 9 o'clock in the evening. The Londons live in a splendid section of the town. When I rapped at the door, a neat little woman opened it and, grabbing my hand, almost wrung it off. A striking young man of 30, with very broad shoulders, a mass of wavy auburn hair, and a general atmosphere of boyishness, appeared at the doorway and shot a quick, inquisitive look at me from his wide gray eyes. Inside the house, I could see all manner of oars, odd assortments of clothing, books, papers, charts, guns, cameras, and folding canoes piled in great stacks on the floor.
December 11th, 1906.
Dear Roscoe, in reply to yours of December 10, all the yachts sailing on the bay have for captains their owners. If I'm not to be captain of my own boat, what the devil am I to be? In fact, your proposition strikes me as a very peculiar one. When you first mentioned it to me in Glenallen, on the spur of the moment, I suggested that you would be sailing master. You'd be known everywhere as Captain Eames. Nevertheless, it is my firm and abiding intention to be myself captain of the Snark. The only formal titles by which I shall designate anybody in my articles will be ridiculous and undignified titles. I put up with no more formalities than I have to. I have no recollection of how I referred to you in my Cosmopolitan article, other than that I called you Roscoe. I shall continue so to call you, unless you ask to be left out, in which case I shall be courteous enough to leave you out, though thereby I shall sacrifice some of the material for writing whereby I hope to pay expenses. As regards facetious remarks dropped by Charmian as to her being mate, all I can say is that they were facetious. She is my mate, but she's not the mate of the Snark and never will be. You seem to believe that mate is a higher formal designation than a sailing master, in which case, why not take mate for your formal designation? Personally, I always thought that sailing master was higher than mate, but I'm rather shaky on such things. Your letter shows me that there must be a captain. Therefore, I have to be captain of the Snark. Affectionately yours, Jack London.
The morning after my arrival in Oakland, I met the other Snarkites, as Mrs. London calls them. Manyungi, the cabin boy, is a manly little fellow of 20. Captain Eames is a fine, kindly old man, the architect and superintendent of construction of the Snark, and is booked to be her navigator.
December 17.
To the editorial department, Cosmopolitan Magazine, gentlemen, I hasten to accept your agreement to terminate our contract.
Fame and popularity have not spoiled Jack and Mrs. London. Jack is just like a big schoolboy, good-natured, frank, and generous. And Mrs. London is just a grown-up schoolgirl. They're good comrades, always helping each other in their work.
December 31st, 1906. Oh, home at last, after a night of wild funning with a chance party of acquaintances in the uproarious cafes and confetti-showered streets of Oakland. And so ends the happiest year of my life, with before me a great adventure. We have sustained the loss of Manyungi. For some time he has been making himself dispensable. Jack is convinced that his only motive was a disinclination to visit the Seven Seas in an inconsequential shallop such as the Snark. All day he had blatantly omitted his habitual address of master, substituting Mr. London, or boss. His bold black eyes and studied nonchalance advertised bid upon bid for discharge. In the evening, I was bending apprehensively over the cribbage board, watching my opponent peg a great advantage, when an ominously quiet but impudent voice behind me asked, "Will God have some beer?" Jack went pale with surprise, but replied composedly, "I do not want anything at all from you, Manyungi." It will mean the breaking of a new hand to all the details of our complicated requirements.
Dear Mr. Brett, in reply to yours of February 28, no. If you put before me good evidence that the publication of The Road would be likely to damage the sale of my other books, it would not affect the question of my desire for you to go ahead and publish it. In The Road, and in all my work, in all that I've said and written and done, I have been true. This is the character I've built up. It constitutes, I believe, my big asset. There have been flurries of antagonism, attacks, and condemnations, but I pulled through them all, and the consistent and true picture of myself is, by that, much more clearly limned. I look back on my life and draw one great generalization. It was my refusal to take cautious advice that made me. And so, in the present case, being cussedly made, I suppose, I feel compelled to follow my own judgment. I had the boat out on a second trial trip last Sunday. She's a sheer delight to me. I could not ask for any alteration in her. She'll not be able to get away until after April 1st. I no longer set definite dates of departure.
The Snark grows and grows, but is never ready.
Jack has been compelled to ask Roscoe to study up on navigation. Jack is too busy to study the art, but he will furnish the books and instruments, and when we get to sea, Roscoe can teach Jack what he's learned.
To Arthur T. Vance, editor, Woman's Home Companion, dear Vance, I wish I knew myself why it is that I did not get started. I'm paying out $1,000 a month wages to workmen alone without taking into account the cost of material, and still the building of the boat drags on. A boat that, at the outside, should have cost no more than $7,000 has already cost me more than $20,000. Post-earthquake conditions and the power of organized labor are responsible for this. On March 28th, the boat goes on the ways again. She's leaked ever since she was launched, and now we'll have to strip the copper off and find the leak. I'm not happy, and I won't be happy until I get away. I'm sorry it throws your arrangements out, but great God, think of the way it throws me out. You've got a bed of roses compared with what I have.
The weeks are passing, and still the Snark is in the building. Jack grows impatient. Roscoe Eames makes promises. The old captain means well, but alas, his good intentions are just like all other good intentions. He tries his best to hurry things along, but nothing can be induced to turn out right. Even the newspapers have begun to ridicule us all.
Roscoe, my co-navigator, is a follower of one Cyrus R. Teed, who has a different cosmology from the one generally accepted. Roscoe believes that the surface of the earth is concave, and that we live on the inside of a hollow sphere. Thus, though we shall sail on the one boat, Roscoe will journey around the world on the inside, while I shall journey round on the outside. We threaten to be of one mind before the voyage is completed.
We're buying 1,001 things. Clothing, fishing tackle, harpoons, guns, pistols, and paper. Paper for Jack's writing, and paper for the typewriter. Hundreds of reams of it. We spend money like water. Day after day brings down to the wharf the things we've purchased, and Mrs. London busies herself directing the work.
It's impossible to finish the Snark in San Francisco. She's been so long in the building that she's beginning to break down and wear out faster than she can be repaired. She's become a joke. Nobody takes her seriously, least of all the men who work on her. We'll sail her just as she is and finish building her in Honolulu.
At 9 o'clock, Captain Eames yelled, "Let her go!" And the Snark slid off her ways as easily as could be desired and took to the bay with the grace of a wild waterfowl.
We were to sail Sunday 21st April at 11. Saturday afternoon arrived. In one pocket I carry a checkbook, a fountain pen, a data, and a blotter. In another pocket I carry between $1,000 and $2,000 in paper money and gold. And then a man arrives. He is a United States Marshal. He tacks a notice on the Snark's brave mast so that all on the wharf can read that the Snark has been libeled for debt.
It seems that a man named L.M. Sellers, who's a ship chandler, has placed the attachment on the Snark. Jack owes him something like $250, and Sellers' account was one of those Jack had intended to close this very day.
It is just the petty trick of a tradesman in a panic. It will not delay me for 1 minute.
Of course, we did not sail Sunday, April 21st, as planned.
We'll get away on Tuesday. Think of it. Once we're out on the ocean, we'll forget all our little worries, the accidents, the Sellerses, and the rest.
I shall never forget that Tuesday, 23rd of April, 1907. Thousands came down to the wharf to bid us goodbye. Photographers took what they reassuringly announced would be the last views of the Snark and her crew.
Away at last. True, the engine in the launch won't run, and the lifeboat leaks like a sieve, but they aren't the Snark. They're mere appurtenances. The things that count are the watertight bulkheads, the solid planking, the bathroom devices. They are the Snark. And then, greatest of all, there's that noble wind-punching bow.
And so we've put forth into the wide Pacific in a mere cork of a boat, without a navigator, with no engineer, no sailors, and for that matter, no cook. Well, this doesn't bother us much, however. We're all too seasick to eat.
I had calculated that youth was the stuff for a voyage of this sort. I'd forgotten to calculate upon seasick youth.
As soon as Tachigi had served dinner, he got out his flute, played the most mournful piece I've ever heard, and as the last note died away, he rushed up on deck and relieved his deathly sickness at the rail. Mrs. London speedily joined him.
Our box of oranges has at some time been frozen.
Our box of apples is mostly spoiled.
The crate of cabbages, spoiled before it was ever delivered to us, has had to go overboard.
The carrots taste of kerosene.
The turnips are woody. The beets rotten.
As for the coal, it was delivered in rotten potato sacks, and in the swinging and thrashing of the ship has escaped and washes through the scuppers into the ocean.
The bathroom is out of commission. The powerful iron levers break off short in your hand.
After earnest and repeated requests, Roscoe has attempted to fix the plumbing and failed.
The deck leaks, and it leaks badly. It drowned Roscoe out of his bunk last night and has ruined the tools in the engine room, to say nothing of the provisions in the galley. Also, the sides of the Snark leak and the bottom leaks, and we must pump to keep her afloat.
Our gasoline, stored in non-leakable tanks and sealed behind an airtight bulkhead, has begun to filter out. The air is full of the smell of it.
A stormy night in prospect. A splash of wet in the air and a promise of squalls to windward. Jack has decided to heave us, too.
I put the wheel down. The Snark rolls in the trough. I put the spokes down harder and harder. She continues rolling in the trough. Under doubled reef mainsail and single reef staysail, the Snark refuses to heave to. The Snark wallows in the trough and drags the sea anchor behind her.
Oh, my head aches. My stomach aches. Every muscle in my body aches. The universe itself is plunging through the cold depths of space.
And so we have run before it for 4 hours. As I write, we are bowling along at a 6-knot clip in the northeast trades. If I had the money or the credit, I'd build another Snark that would heave to. But I'm at the end of my resources. I've got to put up with the present Snark or quit, and I can't quit!
May 2nd, 1907. I feel much better today. I'm trying to clean up the galley. It is getting warmer. No wind, scarcely. I'm making about 2 knots. Mrs. London is certainly a brick. Bears up wonderfully and is everywhere at once. Will we ever reach Honolulu alive?
Roscoe is not a navigator. He is a San Francisco Bay yachtsman. Well, land is always only several miles away, and the art of navigation is never employed.
Evening. Jack and Mrs. London are playing cribbage in the cockpit. Tachigi washing clothes over the rail. Ocean calm, except for the swell that is always felt. We had a fine time at supper, telling stories and joking. Water still spouting in. Pumps needed. Mrs. London has a bad headache. So have I. But a little sleep will cure that. So, here's for the bunk.
Roscoe has the theory all right, but he's never implied it. As is evidenced by the erratic behavior of the Snark on the chart.
May 7th, 1907. Played whist last night and had a fine time. Jack and Mrs. London won both games. Captain Eames looked on until a lamp fell on his head, and after that he seemed to lose interest.
Roscoe is filled with incommunicable information. He stands in reverential awe of himself. The act of finding himself on the waters has become a rite, and he feels himself a superior being.
May 8th, 1907. It's getting awfully monotonous, always swaying up and down on these big waves.
Seamanship is not learnt in a day, nor in many days. But navigating by observation of the sun, moon, and stars is child's play. Any average young fella can teach himself in a week.
We have all kinds of music. Jack has a big talking machine with over 500 records. Every day, Jack writes 2 hours, just 2 hours, no more and no less. He gets up in the morning and takes his trick at the wheel, has breakfast, then shuts himself in his stateroom and writes. He laughs at what he calls the tomfoolery of waiting for inspiration to come. It is plain work, he says, and the only way he can do it is to go ahead and do it. He never rewrites a story. He writes with a fountain pen, and nobody can read his writing but Mrs. London. He turns the manuscript over to her, and she types it and gets it ready for the publishers.
On top of the fun and pleasure, sailing around the world is a splendid education for a young man. Oh, not a mere education in the things of the world outside, but an education in oneself. A chance to get on speaking terms with one's own soul.
Snark feared lost. 27 days have now elapsed since Jack London, his wife, and small crew set sail from San Francisco bound for Hawaii. All hope has been given up of their frail craft reaching port.
Saturday, May 18, 1907. Marvel of marvels, we've really found the islands. This morning, Jack came on deck at 5, and we searched the horizon for an hour and finally gave up. But just then, Mrs. London came on deck and cried,
"Oh!"
And then,
"Isn't that lovely?"
And sure enough, the clouds had parted and disclosed the snow-peaked active volcano of Mauna Loa on the island of Hawaii, only about 20 miles to port.
Casting back over these 26 days of ceaseless tossing, we are aware only of pleasure in the memory of every least happening, disagreeable and agreeable alike. In fact, the last week aboard has been so cozy and homelike that more than often we found ourselves regretting the imminent termination of the cruise.
Commodore Hoburn of the Hawaiian Yacht Club has tendered the use of his bungalow to Jack and Mrs. London. The bungalow is only a few yards from our anchorage, so the Snark family remain within easy hailing distance. We are besieged by reporters and photographers.
Tuesday, May 21st, 1907. Come tread with me a little space of paradise. Many pleasant acres have I trod, but never an acre like this. It is so beautiful and restful and green, green upon green, with blue depth shadows imposed upon thick, deep lawn that cushions underfoot.
We all gape with wonder, all except Jack, who's been here before.
Jack is even more fussy than I about crawly things. This morning he went right into the air before an ill-looking hairy gray spider some 4 or 5 inches across that dropped from the ceiling and clattered upon the bureau top.
For my part, I have plenty of leisure. After an heroic silence, the crew have broken out in protest against my cooking.
When we had finished unpacking, I had a good talk with Tochiki, for I have learned the value of once in a while holding friendly meetings with the servants when readjustments are to be made. Dissatisfied helpers are the doom of domestic happiness.
The people of Oahu are very accommodating, bringing us fruit and looking after our every wish.
Nothing. nothing will do, but Jack must have me whirring off Wagnerian overtures while I patter about in Japanese sandals and he works on the lawn in his kimono. May 23rd, 1907. This morning, Tsuchigi led us to where he had laid a little table under the still trees, strewn it with single red hibiscus and glossy coral peppers, and then served a faultless breakfast of papaya, shirred eggs, a curled shaving of bacon, and fresh buttered toast, with perfect coffee brewed in the Snark's percolator.
While the socialists are gloating over the gruesome picture of the impending struggle that Jack London painted in the Iron Heel, and the powers that be are fixing his status for once and for all in the class of undesirable citizens, the irresponsible London himself appears to be taking matters very calmly. The accompanying photograph does not indicate that he is spending his days in brooding over the cataclysm. On the contrary, he looks remarkably well-fed, happy, and contented for a socialist. But there are socialists and socialists.
May 28th. This date marks a vital readjustment in ship's matters. Uncle Roscoe is to return to the mainland.
Captain Eames has decided that he's had enough of yachting and departs for California on the steamship Sierra. Of course, the newspapers can never get through inventing lies and falsehoods about Jack and the rest of us. As a matter of fact, there's never been so much as a quarrel among us.
Disagreements there have been, but I employ the wrong word, for it was an agreement, quietly arrived at between Jack and his sailing master before we sighted Honolulu, that the latter should go home at his leisure from that port.
Dear Aunt Netta, the $5,000 check from Mr. Brett came straight through to me, and I've banked it. Anint Roscoe, my dear woman, can't you understand that my complaint against Roscoe is that he was never overworked at all because he did practically no work at all. He didn't do one-fifth part as much as Charmian did on the trip down. Lack of sleep? He slept more than any two of us on the boat put together the whole trip down. Roscoe's bowels may have been out of order, but let me tell you one thing, Aunt Netta. When a man eats more heavily than is his wont and sleeps half the time and loafs seven-eighths of the remaining half of the time, that man's going to get constipated. When I asked him on the last day if everything was in good condition on the Snark, he said yes. And at that very moment, he knew and I knew that there were 10,000 things that ought to have been done upon the Snark, that the decks had not been washed for 12 days and were opening up, that big hawsers were lying rotting on the deck in tropic heat and moisture, that the big mainsail was mildewing, that the mast should be scraped. I say he knew all these things, or else he was the damnedest imbecile that ever trod on God Almighty's footstool. And then to have him threaten me, if I didn't watch out,
he'd talk to the reporters in self-defense.
Ha! And now, no more of Roscoe, dear Aunt Netta. I'm glad that you've purchased a good span of horses. I want to go ahead with the ranch in every possible way. If I should go broke on this yacht trip, I shall have all the better refuge to retreat to.
Seaside Hotel, Waikiki Beach. Oh, the music! Only one regret. Jack will not dance. Jack never dances. Says he never had time to learn and is now too old.
As I write these lines, I lift my eyes and look seaward. Through the white crest of a breaker suddenly appears a dark figure. Erect. A man-fish or sea-god, buried to his loins in smoking spray, caught up by the sea and flung landward bodily a quarter of a mile. It is a Kanaka on a surfboard. When I've finished these lines, I'll be out there in that riot of color and pounding surf trying to hit those breakers even as he, and failing as he never failed, but living life as the best of us may live it.
Nursing my own reddened skin in the cool tent house, I saw a weary figure dragging itself across the lawns. It was Jack. His shoulders and the back of his neck were cruelly grilled, goodness knows, but the really frightful damage was wrecked on the backs of his legs, especially the tender hind side of the knee joints.
Much work is being done on the Snark. Men have come from Honolulu and are putting everything ship-shape. All this time, Jack and Mrs. London are making visits to the neighboring islands, so we see little of them.
Honolulu, Wednesday, August 14, 1907. Tomorrow we embark once more on our boat of dreams for the Big Island, whence, if the engine proves capable and our new skipper, Captain James Langan Warren of Virginia, measures up to Jack's judgment, we shall sail from Hilo in earnest for the South Seas.
After nearly a week of sailing, we've sighted Haleakala. The way Captain Warren brought the Snark head up into the wind and lowered anchor was a marvel to us landlubbers, who up to now have been sailing the vessel as a boy would float a tub. The captain sails and anchors the boat as a boat should be sailed and anchored. He gives his orders in a tone that leaves nothing for us to do but obey. Jack and Mrs. London have decided to go overland across the island to Hilo.
Friday, September 6th, to Hilo. Thus far, in all our junketing, we have relied on private conveyances of one sort or another. But today's journeying, in the middle seat of three, luggage strapped on behind the four-in-hand stage, was a unique and profitable experience. The overcrowding was ludicrous. At each stop on the way, a bevy of Japanese would literally pile themselves upon us. Jack would say, with laughing eyes and smiling set lips, while he thrust his big shoulders this way and that, "Gee, I like to look at them, but they'd camp on us if we'd let them."
At last comes the hour for our departure. I think we all have deep regrets at leaving Hawaii. The months spent here have been happy ones, and it is a sorrow to part with our friends. And little Tochigi, who's been a bundle of Japanese misery every minute at sea since leaving San Francisco, has said goodbye to us.
For some 5 months we have spent in the various islands of the Hawaiian group. Being ashore, I drink. I even drink a bit more than I was accustomed to drink in California prior to the voyage. The people in Hawaii seem to drink a bit more on the average than the people in more temperate latitudes.
Tomorrow, the dream-freighted Snark, carrying only three of her initial adventurers, Jack, Martin, and myself, sails for the Marquesas Islands, toward which Jack's sea-roving spirit has yearned from boyhood, since first he devoured Melville's tale, Taipei. Besides the captain, the berth of the sorely regretted Tochigi is occupied by one Noshimatu Nakata, a moon-faced Nipponese manling of 18 who speaks no English. Martin has been graduated from galley to engine room, and Wada, a Japanese chef, is now in charge of our cooking. 1:30, and early aboard, where we await a few belated deliveries from the uptown shops and the friends who are to see us off. Frankly, I am nervous. And Jack has done his 1,000 words as usual. He now stands about the shining holy stone deck, unconsciously lighting cigarettes without number and as unconsciously dropping them overboard half-smoked. He is not talking much. We got over the goodbyes somehow. A westering sun floods with golden light, the city clearing from its silver shower, and we know that some, at least, of her thoughts are with us happy estrays on the white-specked boat adventuring the pathless ocean.
This morning, Wada, giving an overhauling to the galley, made a find. Down in the bottom of a deep locker, he found a dozen bottles of Angelica and Muscatel. I took a taste. Delicious. 6 months in the galley heat have effected some sort of a change in the thick, sweet wine. Branded it, I imagine. And so, once a day, at noon, after our observations are worked up and the Snark's position charted, I drink half a tumbler of this stuff. Ooh, it has a rare kick to it. It warms the cockles of my geniality and puts a fair face on the truly fair face of the sea. Trouble is, I have to share the stuff.
It has often been noticed how soon a small party will get grumpy if they are together for a long time. But we are an exception to the rule. Our days are spent amicably up on deck, and in the evenings, Jack and Mrs. London and Captain Warren and I go below to play cards.
November 24th, 1907. On board the Snark. 12620 west longitude, 647 north latitude. To George Sterling.
Oh, you Greek. Did anybody ever tell you that it's a hard voyage from Hawaii to the Marquesas? Anyway, you tell the next fellow so if he's tackling it in a sailing vessel. The South Sea Directory says that the whale ship captains doubted if it could be accomplished. My work goes on every day and every day. I have 95,000 words written on a new novel, which will be about 120,000 words long, the longest one I've written. Shall entitle it Success, perhaps, or Martin Eden. The story is drawn largely from my own experience. It treats of the struggles of a young fellow determined to make good at writing, of his eventual success and of his unhappy death. But it's more than a story. Through it runs a certain cosmic undertone that makes it a record of universal truths. The thing is true, not only of Martin Eden, but of all life, of all time. Feeling fine, in great condition. Lots of fun catching fish and losing at poker. Also, studying navigation. At present, I'm well able to navigate a ship anywhere in the world. When I get back, if I want to, it'll be a snap to get my captain's papers.
Tuesday, December 3, 1907. Captain Warren says we're 360 miles from land and still going. It's funny to see us crowd around the chart at noon as the captain puts our position on it. A large frigate bird followed us all day. They never go far from land, so we were glad to see them. December 5th. I just got through giving Nakata a lesson in English. He knew no English at all at the start of the voyage, and now can understand most anything told him. Friday, December 6, 1907. Midnight. We are anchored in the prettiest bay I ever imagined. Oh, but let me begin at the first. My brain is so full of things to write that I know I will never do them justice, for I have not the time or paper. Early this morning, Captain Warren awoke us with "Land ahoy!" How good those big green mountains looked. Only men who'd been 60 days on the sea could appreciate the scene. It seemed as if we were in another world as we sailed past several low coconut islands, sometimes going so close that with the glasses we could see villages of grass houses. And we knew that at last we were in the real South Sea Islands. At last we are at anchor. It seems that we must be in paradise. The air is perfume. We can hear the wild goats bleating in the mountains and an occasional long-drawn howl from a dog ashore. It's so near morning now that the cocks are crowing, and we're so proud of ourselves for doing what the sailing direction said was impossible, and so happy at seeing land again. Well, now we shall get a much-needed rest.
From Hawaii, we sailed for the Marquesas. For 60 days, we never raised land, a sail, nor a steam of smoke. So it was that I reached the Marquesas, the possessor of a real man-sized thirst. In the Marquesas are several white men, a lot of sickly natives, much magnificent scenery, plenty of trade rum, an immense quantity of absinthe, but neither whiskey nor gin. The trade rum scorches the skin off one's mouth. I know because I've tried it. The trouble with the absinthe is that one has to take such inordinate quantities in order to feel the slightest effect. From the Marquesas, we will sail with sufficient absinthe and ballast to last us to Tahiti, where we will outfit with Scotch and American whiskey.
Our favorite loafing place is the German trader's headquarters. Here the natives bring curios for us to buy. It is our custom to buy knives and sticks of tobacco of the company at white man's prices and trade them to the natives at brown man's prices. A knife which costs us 25 cents, we can trade to the Marquesans at $1 value. 400% is the regular scale of South Sea profit.
Of all the inhabitants of the South Seas, the Marquesans were judged the strongest and most beautiful. Now, all this strength and beauty has departed. And the Valley of Taipei, Melville's magnificent Taipei, is the abode of some dozen wretched creatures afflicted by leprosy, elephantiasis, and tuberculosis. The white man imported the microbes of disease, and the Taipeans went down before them. One is almost driven to the conclusion that the white race flourishes on impurity and corruption.
We'd been in the Marquesas Islands a little over 2 weeks when Jack decided that we'd better be getting on. So on December 18, we left Teohe Bay at 7:30 in the evening.
I haven't received a letter for 3 months, and another month will probably elapse before I pick up a mountain of mail in Tahiti. You know what my mail is. Think of 4 months of it coming in one swat.
In the 10 weeks' mail we have picked up in Tahiti, there is a missive from Jack's children's mother announcing her approaching nuptials. His natural paternal interest, combined with news of the present panic apparently besieging Wall Street, have determined a break in the voyage.
To George P. Brett, Macmillan Company.
Papeete, Tahiti, January 16, 1908.
In reply to yours of September 18, 21, 27, October 5, 21, 29, November 7, December 2, 3, and 16, I am now on board the SS Mariposa bound for San Francisco. I shall only be in San Francisco 8 days, sailing from there on Monday morning, February 3rd, on the SS Mariposa for Tahiti, where we rejoin the Snark and continue our voyage around the world. We found 90 days' mail waiting for us in Papeete, and most of it was bad news. Here I must thank you for your kindness in helping Mrs. Nanetta Eames out with my affairs in California. Things happened fast and furious with her for a while, and several payments I'd expected from various sources failing to materialize, she was pretty hard-pressed. Believing that we were all drowned, my bank had foreclosed the mortgage on the Oakland house and failed to honor $800 worth of checks I cashed in Hawaii. Other bills there were in plenty. On a swift calculation, my assets stand at $66, and my liabilities are enormous. Now, this is where you come in. If you can see your way clear to letting me have $5,000 in advance of royalties on my new book, Martin Eden, which should be in your hands within a month, this will go a long way towards settling things for me. Now, let me emphasize, with this novel, I am hot. It's big stuff and will sell. I sincerely believe it's what I've been working toward all my writing life. Please, let me have your view of my proposition at your earliest convenience. You can contact me through Mrs. Eames any time after my arrival in San Francisco. Yours as ever, Jack London.
The smile that won't come off. Jack London has troubles, big troubles. Half of California and a third of the world is at his throat demanding settlement of outstanding debts. But when he shipped for Tahiti yesterday morning aboard the SS Mariposa, his smile was broader than ever as he clowned with reporters. He is still boy, all boy, whenever the subject of his pet, the Snark, is raised. Jack may be down, but he is by no means out.
To the editor, Honolulu Advertiser, dear sir, the bystander on the staff of the Advertiser has made some most provincial and untrue remarks about me. Here is some of the abuse which he has heaped upon me. I am a sneak of the first water, a thoroughly untrustworthy man, and an ungrateful and untruthful bounder. And now, Mr. Editor, let me give you a few facts of my visit to Hawaii. I came to Hawaii on my own, subsidized by nobody. Nor did Hawaii subsidize me. Nor did I ask Hawaii to subsidize me. I paid my way. I spent a few $1,000s in Hawaii, and there is no man in Hawaii who can lift up his voice and say that I owe him 1 cent. On the other hand, I can lift up my voice and say that the citizens of Hawaii owe me a great many cents.
Captain Warren in his new white clothes will promenade about Papeete, telling everyone that he is captain of the Snark. Well, he really is a pretty good fellow, but he takes himself too seriously.
February 15, 1908. To Hayden Carruth, editor, Woman's Home Companion.
I'm just writing you a howl. If you'll remember, there were two reasons that impelled me to cancel my contract with the Cosmopolitan for the boat trip of the Snark. One reason was their blue penciling of my work. The other and major reason was because they were advertising that they were sending me around the world. Now, here you are, doing precisely the same thing. And everywhere I've been, the prices have been raised and stuck into me and broken off, all upon the understanding that I wasn't spending my money, but I was spending the money of a rich magazine in the United States. Your miserable and untrue advertising has cost me much more than the $1,000 you advanced me. And it's put my voyage in the eyes of my friends and in the eyes of the public upon a totally different basis from its true basis. Now, I don't know what you're going to do to rectify it, but rectify it you must. Somehow.
Everyone smokes in the South Seas. Girls, children, men and women, and all drink. The Kanakas would drink our cognac and absinthe like beer did we allow it.
Papeete, Tahiti, February 17, 1908.
Oh, you Greek. Your long letter came down in the mailbags on our steamer and was delivered to us here. I can't get a line on why you wish I hadn't written The Road. It's all true. It's what I've done. And it's part of the process by which I have become. Is it a lingering taint of the bourgeois in you? We sail from here in several days for Samoa, the Fijis, New Caledonia, and the Solomons. Charmian sends loads of love. I send you all mine.
April 25th, 1908. We're getting into the thickest of the South Sea Islands. Every mile we move towards the west is bringing us among more primitive people. The wind is so light that we move along very slowly. There's very little work to be done on board except to keep watch. We lounge around on deck and eat fruit or play cards. Mrs. London has brought her ukulele.
He would seem to have forgotten how ardently in Tahiti he wanted to rehabilitate his reputation and how much Jack overlooked of his misconduct. And nowadays he is more or less of a blight upon the gaiety of our adventure.
Jack has tops and skipping ropes aboard the Snark. And the ropes give us much-needed exercise, and we all take boyish pleasure in spinning the tops. I've seen Jack London squat down and spin his tops by the hour, thoroughly absorbed in the fun. He says that this, like his cigarette, soothes his nerves.
Off Savai Island, Thursday, May 14, 1908. The volcano is classic tonight. The cone showing clearer, the smoke rising funnel-wise to a great height, now and then blown into fantastic spirals by the high winds. There is something sinister and sullen about the glaring, flaring, unnatural light.
Everyone else on the boat is awestruck. They're leaning over the rail in wonder. But my heart is in my mouth, for if the wind drops and the engines stop, it will be all up with us. Nothing can keep us away from those cascades of lava.
To put on paper what I behold is like painting a picture, and I am no artist. But there is a fascination in trying to share with the many what so few may see. And now it has grown too dark to write. I shall give myself up entirely to this terrific experience. I am filled with unutterable disgust over the sleepless fate that sometimes cuts me off from doing the things I wish to do. Arrangements were made for a horseback trip to the volcano today. But I was too tired from a wakeful night to face long hours in the hot sun. Martin was to have been my escort, for Jack has an uncomfortable sore on his foot which worries us by its unhealable character, especially when we recall Ernest's disease.
Everyone on board suspects that Captain Warren is to be discharged at Suva, Fiji. Warren got angry at Wada and broke his nose. And if it hadn't been for Mrs. London, I think he would have laid Nakata out, too.
Things are not improved aboard the Snark. Jack has now definitely decided to get rid of Captain Warren and take over the navigating himself. May 21st. Sea continues boisterous with plenty of wind. I am verging on nausea, and Jack has already been head over rail. His swords are not improving. Warren has hardly spoken all day. Oh, what can he be thinking of? However, we do not act as if anything were out of the way. We chat cheerily at table, play cribbage and poker evenings, quite as if he were normal and approved. But there is no discipline aboard, no work cut out for the men. Everything is now after Suva. Jack looks cheerily at worn and neglected tackle and says, "When we get to Suva, I'll do so-and-so." Suva is our Mecca, and after Suva,
Paradise.
Directly we dropped anchor in Suva, Captain Warren went ashore. He would have everyone know that Captain Warren of the Snark was in town. His boasting led him from saloon to saloon, and soon he was so drunk he could hardly walk. I left him telling of his sea experiences to a bunch of barflies and went to the hotel and had late dinner with the Londons.
Warren did not go near the yacht for 2 days.
Jack instructed me to pack all of the captain's possessions and take them ashore. Also, not to allow the captain to come on board again.
No, I'm going to have no more captains on the Snark. There are captains and captains and some mighty fine captains, I know, but the run of captains on the Snark has been extremely otherwise.
June 6, 1908. Our departure from Suva this morning had all the snap and go of a new adventure. The blight has been wiped out and Mr. London is skipper. It is after Suva, and everyone is merry. June 7. Jack slept but 3 hours owing to a bad cold as well as the responsibility of the boat and did not try to write today, but busied himself getting a hold of everything and, most important, brushing up on navigation. He gave us all a serious talk about our responsibilities. Watching him today, it puzzles me how he's going to accomplish all he's laid out in addition to his writing. We are so proud of ourselves. I rose at 6 and joined Jack at the cockpit rail just an instant after he had spotted the dim but unmistakable high cone of Futuna. And it was exactly where it ought to be. This was his first unaided landfall as captain and navigator of his own little ship, with a burden of lives in his care. I could have wept with delight, but remained very still, for Jack was still too, although pleased clear through, with that little half-bashful smile he wears when he sits under praise. Port Resolution, Tanna, New Hebrides, June 12, 1908. There's certainly something disjointed about it. So lovely a land, so low an order of inhabitants.
It is hard to tell of these savages. They're only 1 degree removed from animals. I wish I might speak plainly. These are a people who are as directly opposed to us in their views of morality as can be imagined. They're sex worshippers. And their ideas of right and wrong lead them to call attention to the very subjects we seek to hide and dismiss from our minds.
As I write, nearby but not too near, they may be clean but they don't look it, squat a half a dozen of the strangest human beings I have ever beheld. Bodies are thin and unbeautiful, with bulges in the wrong places, legs show thin and crooked, and their evil, low-browed Papuan faces are curiously repulsive. One old fellow has a wrinkled face with unsecret, sky-turned nostrils. The eyes, most remarkable, with the vacillatory intentness of a monkey while he endeavors to compose his attention on the typewriter at which I have been working on deck. He is quite the nearest to a chimpanzee I've ever seen. Jack looks like a white giant moving among them. June 26. Jack has gleaned enough from our medical shelf to feel confident in diagnosing his trouble as fistula. He has a new crop of sores, too, and ample company, for Martin, Wada, and Nakata are all now nursing bad ulcers. But Henry and Tahe are gloriously healthy, and I am not afraid, for I practically never catch anything.
The crews of vessels remaining any considerable time in the Solomons find wounds and sores liable to change into malignant ulcers. New arrivals are almost certain sooner or later to suffer from fever. The natives are also subject to it. The number of deaths among the whites in the year 1897 and amounted to 9 among a population of 50.
Penduffryn Plantation, Island of Guadalcanal, Solomon Islands, July 9, 1908. Here I find myself in the queerest situation. In a big house with a retinue of servants, culled from cannibal tribes on a copra plantation in the heart of the terrible Solomons. I am guest of the English owner, and my own man has gone across the water to enter the snark at the port of call, Gubutu, on Florida Island. Incidentally, this will be the third night Jack was ever away from me.
There are traders, old and young, Bechtemer fishermen, old beachcombers and blackbirders. All were delighted to hear of visitors at Penduffryn.
Mr. Harding says that Jack and I will make the mistake of our lives if we do not stay around here a few months, making Penduffryn our base. I am so fascinated by the prospect that I have promised to do something I seldom attempt. Coax my husband.
All this week, the largest group of white men ever gathered on Guadalcanal has made things hum.
And my skipper says yes.
Everyone happy, acting like children. The merrymaking ended when all agreed to take the oriental dope called hashish. Jack took it and went clear off his head, acting so wild that Mrs. London was frightened. No one else would take it. It was to have been my turn next.
July 15. On Sunday, Jack came down suddenly with an attack of the vicious malaria one must battle with in the Solomons. Promptly, he went out of his head and, after raving a while, fell asleep in the violent sweat we induced with blankets and hot water bottles. In 3 hours, he was on his feet, weak but cheerful, and enjoyed a hearty dinner.
Captain Jansen of the Minota has invited Jack and Mrs. London to go along on a blackbirding cruise to Malaita. Meanwhile, I'll remain here, in charge of the snark.
Recruiting plantation laborers on a small, narrow yacht built for harbor sailing is not any too nice. The decks swarm with recruits and their families. The main cabin is packed with them. At night, they sleep there. The only entrance to our tiny cabin is through the main cabin, and we jam our way through them or walk over them. Nor is this nice. One and all, they are afflicted with every form of malignant skin disease. The itching is intolerable. They scratch until the air is filled with fine, dry flakes. Then there are the yaws, and many other skin ulcerations. And so we live and eat and sleep on the Minota, taking our chance and pretending it is good.
And yet it is wonderful to lie here, pistols and extra cartridges under our pillows, a rifle apiece alongside on the couch, realizing the slashing riskiness of the situation. Nothing between us and danger except our wardfulness and our lucky stars.
We have one magic formula, damn the expense when fun is selling, and it doesn't matter whether the price is in dollars, hide, or life. It's our way and our luck. It works. And we've never been gouged on the price yet.
All this day, Jack has been kind enough not to jeer at me. For at last I have a well-developed Solomon Island sore abaft my ankle bone. I tied a raffish bow in the bandage, and Jack said that even in my rags I was picturesque. I have been conning over a fascinating plan to adopt some attractive pickaninny and take her home with me. I have visions of a perfectly trained treasure of a maid.
I'm looking forward to getting out of this particular part of the world. It's too wild and raw. Too full of sickness and sudden death.
No. The Solomon Islands are not as healthy as they might be. I'm writing this article on the island of Ysabel, where we've taken the snark to careen in cleaner copper. I got over my last attack of fever this morning and have had only one free day between attacks. Charmians are 2 weeks apart.
August 28th. Fever grows to be all in the day's work here.
Wada is a wreck from fever. Henry, a strapping giant of a Tahitian, just up from his last dose of fever, is dragging around the deck like a last year's crabapple. Also, they've caught a new form of gari-gari, which literally translated means scratch-scratch. But they're not unique in this. And poor Nakata. For 3 weeks he's been unable to sit down. Furthermore, he's just come down with his seventh attack of fever.
September 7, 1908. Today, Wada, terrified by light recurrent attacks of fever, announced his intention to quit the snark. It followed the serving of an inexcusably overripe goat stew, which Jack pushed aside. Wada was somewhat taken aback by the way Jack accepted and accelerated his resignation.
Jack has promised Nakata a new suit of clothes if he'll do the cooking until we can get a new cook.
I'm doing the work of five men. I'm navigator, sailor, doctor, writer, and inquisitive traveler. Oh, and sixth, I'm master and owner of a craft in strange places where visitors are rare and where visitors are made much of. Here I have to hold up the social end. Entertain on board, be entertained ashore by planters, traders, governors, captains of war vessels, kinky-headed cannibal kings, and prime ministers sometimes fortunate enough to be clad in cotton shirts.
On board the Snark, between Yasabel and Lord Howe Atoll, September 12, 1908. Did ever a yacht's company spend such a day? Land there should have been, and land there was none.
Of course I drink. I drink with my guests and hosts, also I drink by myself. Doing the work of five men entitles me to drink. Alcohol is good for a man who has to overwork. And you should see what it does for my crew.
We are so sick and miserable with fever, yaws, and food poisoning that very little attention has been paid to navigation. And for several days, we've sailed in a half-hearted way looking for Lord Howe Atoll. Jack's observations indicate that we've sailed clear over the top of it.
With the worry of this unaccountable situation, with fever threatening and a new crop of small sores eating into his nerves, I don't see how my husband can be so merry.
White men in the tropics undergo radical changes of nature. They become savage, merciless, and they drink as they never drank before. Drinking is one form of the many forms of degeneration that set in when white men are exposed too long to too much white light. The tropics is no place for a long sojourn.
It is the witching hour of midnight. After a raving period of fever burning, Jack is sleeping with one eye half open. And I wish he would either close it or wake up. He looks so ghastly.
At the moment of writing this, we are lost at sea somewhere northeast of Yasabel and trying vainly to find Lord Howe Island, which cannot be sighted unless one is on top of it. The chronometer's gone wrong. We have had nothing but squalls and rain for days and days.
Rain, rain, rain. There is no sun to dry out above and below, and we must endure the encroaching moldiness. I peer into lockers, fingering the wax paper wrappings of my perishable clothing to see if they are intact, for these are disastrous conditions for silk stuffs and gold threads, and the very atmosphere implants indelible rust spots in cotton and linen.
Nakata is down on his back with fever. Martin is just up from fever and going down again. Charmian is looking up in her date book to find when her next attack will be. My own attacks hit me with the suddenness of bludgeon blows.
I am happy. I am having a good time, the time of times, for I am doing what I want to do in the company I crave, and too absorbed in the potentialities of being to be more than superficially arrested by the flip of little irks and fears.
We don't know when we'll make land. Our Solomon sores are worse than ever and more numerous.
There is more than a vague depression among us this evening, in spite of Tehei's nice supper and exciting rubber of whist and my efforts on the baby guitar to liven things up.
Someday I'll write a book and call it Around the World on the Hospital Ship, Snark.
Lord Howe Atoll, September 19, 1908. Jack is a bit shaky with fever, and a peculiar swelling has appeared in his hands. It hurts him to close them, and the skin peels off in patches, with other skins readily forming and peeling underneath. I do not feel well any of the time. I'm tired and listless. But a strange elation of happiness possesses me, and all's well.
At sea, between Tasman Atoll and Manning Straits. Tehei's attack has developed into Blackwater fever, the severest form of malarial fever.
Jack is treating him very carefully. What a terrible thing a death on the Happy Snark would be.
Only the cockroaches flourish. Neither illness nor accident ever befalls them, and they grow larger and more carnivorous day by day, gnawing our finger and toenails while we sleep.
Thursday, October 8, 1908. Oh, so tired. So tired. Spent forenoon in bed. But my passive illness is nothing besides the active stress of Jack's lamentable hands.
I am far from well. With the exception of the insanity cases, I'm the worst off on board. It's only by a painful effort that I can close my hands. A pull on the rope is excruciating.
At last, after 2 months away, we've dropped anchor again in Pendruffin. Our yaws and Jack's undiagnosed illness are so bad that the doctors of Australia are our only hope.
When we return from Australia, all mended and fresh for a new start, we shall go aboard the Snark and immediately fill away to the west. Always west. The round world round until we are bound at last around Cape Horn and north to San Francisco.
October 25th to George P. Brett Macmillan Company. Just dropping you a line from the Solomon Islands. I've just returned here from a voyage on the Snark up to Lord Howe and Tasman Islands. We were gone over 2 months, and most of the time, most of us was sick. Mrs. London ably performs her part as chief nurse and able seaman. Speaking seriously about books, I've just been casting up what I have on hand. Lost Face. 52,000 words. This will be the last collection of Klondike short stories I shall ever bring out. Revolution and Other Essays, 45,000 words. When God Laughs, 42,000 words. Tropic Tales, 53,000 words. The Snark Book, 81,000 words, which will conclude the voyage of the Snark in the Pacific. For from here we go on into the East Indies. I sail in about 5 days on the steamer to Sydney. I am going into hospital for an operation. And then I expect to fool around several months in Australia, New Zealand, and Tasmania. And, of course, she'll go on writing.
Jack writes daily, except when the violence of fever attacks lay him low. His various ailments grow steadily worse. Out of my own fever come moods of despondency, most unlike my happy-go-lucky wont.
Pendarfin, Guadalcanal, October 26. Dear Aunt Netta, I haven't received any of the Batavia mail yet. I've not yet told you. I mean, if I've not yet told you, please keep track and let me know the dates of publication and in what magazines of all my stuff in the United States and England. You speak vaguely in your letter of getting boxes ready to ship, but at present, I have no clue as to whether or not you've shipped any boxes at all to me. This year, you've sent me my monthly account for the month of May only, under the date of June 15. In all of the Port Moresby letters, you sent me only one monthly account for February. And at the foregoing, the letter dated June 14 is addressed to Charmian, not to me. You did just right in selling Martin Eden to the Pacific Monthly. Mildew in boxes shipped by us is practically unavoidable. Hence the extreme necessity of unpacking said boxes when received and airing the contents and storing away in a dry place. When I started on this voyage, I told you to set your own price on your time. You set $10 a month. When you asked for 20, I gave it to you and backdated the raise. When this time you decided $30 a month was all right, you saved me the trouble of backdating the raise. Now I say all right. Let me be frank. The tone of your letter would suggest to the honest, ordinary reader that Jack London was not paying you enough, and furthermore that he was a rather stingy fellow. If you feel I'm overworking and underpaying you, why, it's up to you to set your own price upon your time. And now to other things. The thought strikes me that in the earlier bunch of letters,
There may have been the monthly statements of account, which I filed separately. The more I think of it, the more I'm sure that this is so. But in the bunch of letters I'm answering now, I am absolutely sure that there was but one accompanying monthly statement. One of the things I've prided myself on since I've had a dollar to spend has been that everybody that ever did anything for me has always been well paid. I tried to read between the lines and work out whether or not you are averse to going on handling my affairs. If you are, please do say so. I'm satisfied, and I want you to be satisfied. But if you're not satisfied, please do not put the responsibility upon me of making me say quit. That's for you to say. Now, concerning the stories of mine, which you have sent the rounds of all the paying publications, don't offer them to the newspapers. Newspapers never pay. File them away and hold on to them. In the meantime, send me a list of the manuscripts that have gone all the rounds with the list of magazines to which each one has been sent. With lots of love, Jack.
October 31st, 1908.
You blessed Greek. In all these months, no letter from you. Don't know how Charmy and I would have survived had it not been for Carrie's splendid long letter. I have yet to receive my mail forwarded from Batavia, and I imagine you've a couple of good long letters for me in that bunch. I haven't written any letters for months and months, with the exception of one long, delayed one to Whittaker. I'm leaving here in 2 days to go to Sydney, where I go into hospital for an operation. And I have other afflictions from a medical standpoint, vastly more serious than the operation. The foregoing will serve to explain somewhat why I'm not writing letters these days. But that's no reason why you shouldn't write me, good long ones.
And in this atmosphere of merciless carnage, Jack and I performed our regular work, read books, played cards, and embroidered on fine linen.
The sunsickness got me. I drank more heavily during this time, but right here I wish to forestall misunderstanding. The drinking was not the cause of my sickness.
Sydney, Australia, December 22nd, 1908, to George P. Brett, Macmillan Company.
Dear Mr. Brett, in reply to yours of May 4, 1908, which has been tangled up in Dutch East Indies and has finally come to hand, or rather, it has been to hand for a couple of months, but I've been lying sick in hospitals and hotels and been unable to reply to it or any other letters. This sickness has led to a change in my plans. My obscure affliction defies all the doctors of Australia.
Several skin specialists puzzle and theorize over Jack's pitiful hands, the like of which they have never seen or even heard. They conclude that it is entirely of nervous origin.
I am practically helpless, unable to cut a piece of cold meat with a knife and fork. Of course, in this condition, it would be impossible for me to travel on the high seas on the Snark. Because of all of which, and with deep sorrow on Mrs. London's part, as well as my own, I am compelled to abandon the voyage.
I was dazed. For an hour, I didn't know what to do. I went to the St. Malo Hospital and inquired for Jack. I was shown up to where he was lying. Mrs. London was in bed in the same room, sick with fever. She could scarcely speak of the Snark, she felt so bad. Well, Jack explained to me.
I shall sell out the Snark in Sydney and go back to the climate where I've always succeeded in maintaining a stable nervous equilibrium in the hope that my equilibrium will be restored.
We have rented an apartment in Sydney and work and play as best we can. But it is not all pleasure, for Jack's hands do not improve, but go on swelling and peeling prodigiously.
Please find herewith signed contract for 1909. My deepest thanks for advancing me that last $5,000, which has come safely to hand. Since I'm returning home, affairs will be easier with me, and I do not imagine that I shall be compelled in the future to throw myself so remorselessly upon your kindness in the matter of making heavy advances on royalties. Since my last letter to you, telling you of the various books I'd completed, or nearly completed, I've not written one line. I've been too sick. It isn't Mrs. London's fault that the log of the Snark hasn't reached you before this. I've been holding it for the purpose of going over it and have been unable to get round to it. Sincerely yours, Jack London.
February 14.
Dearest Aunt Netta, all mail came safely to hand at Pernada, but it did not contain the dates of publication. I have not yet received any dates of publication. Well, glad you like the photo. Who is Theodore T. Dowdle, architect? Is he the one who designed Mama's house? Charmian is beginning to look like herself again and to have more zest in life than she's shown for some time. And, let me tell you that malarial fever, like Solomon Island sores, can be contracted by the purest living persons in the world. Gee, there'll be a lot for us to see when we get home. The new ranch, the big tank, and all the rest. I can't tell you how glad we are to get back. Hurrah for the cook! She'll be well broken in by the time we get there. With lots of love, dear mother mine. Jack.
March 3rd, 1909.
Dearest Greek, Snark has just arrived from Solomon's. Shall sell her for any sum, no matter how small, then head for California.
It is a terrible strain, going daily to the Snark on a little ferry boat to oversee the packing of gear that we are sending home.
People are coming to look at the Snark, and she will soon be sold. I shall remain until another engineer takes hold. Then I shall go on to Europe. I had dinner with the Londons at the Australian Hotel. They're quite heartbroken at giving up the cruise. Time came for me to go. We said little in parting. There was nothing to say.
On board SS Timorick, May 2, 1909, off Pitcairn Island.
I'm not writing a long letter, as we'll soon be home. Took this opportunity of voyaging on a tramp steamer. The voyage will last 40 days. I'm getting in a condition. Haven't had a drink for a month, but I think they know how to make dry martinis in Guayaquil. You damn Greek. Love to Carrie. Tell her I have some splendid Samoan tapa for her, and a war club and spears for you, to say nothing of a clitoris. Dried, with appurtenances attached, and strung on a string for an ear ornament. Am already planning for California. We shall live at Wake Robin this summer, and then next summer, build a house. The ranch is one hell of a place, and we'll make it one hell of a lot more of a place by the time we finish with it. It'll last 1,000 years, and we'll people it with enough Londons to last that 1,000 years and more. Say, I've been reading up on eucalyptus. If I could tell you the profits of eucalyptus growing, you'd quit poetry and buy a forest.
And believe it or not, ye of little faith in the joy that was ours on the voyage, our one ultimate hope of earthly bliss is to fit out another and larger boat and do it all over again and more, and do it more leisurely, more wisely, under the tropic sun.
November 23rd, 1916. London Ranch, Glen Ellen, California. At about 6:30 p.m., November 21st, 1916, Mr. Jack London partook of his dinner. He was taken ill during the night with what was supposed to be an attack of acute indigestion. This, however, proved to be a gastrointestinal type of uremia, following an error in diet and causing a faulty elimination of the kidneys. He rapidly entered coma and died at 7:45 p.m., November 22nd, 1916.
Jack was compiled and written by Steve May. The cast: Jack London, Keith Alexander, Charmian London, Kate Harper, Martin, Peter Whitman, and the voice of the press, William Roberts. The program was directed in Bristol by Brian Miller.